first system I want to talk to you about is the really binaire system. Just in case somebody doesn't know what it is, which is highly unlikely, there's a sketch of it here. We have a bottom plate and a top plate, and there's a fluid in between. We heat it from below with some heat current Q. You get a temperature difference, delta T. The sample has a thickness D. And when delta T exceeds a critical value, convection will start in the system. And below the critical value, the deterministic equations of motion will tell you that there is nothing going on. There's just a linear temperature gradient in the system, but there's no velocity field. Now, what I actually want to talk about is what happens just in that region where the Navier-Stokes equation tells us that nothing should happen. Because the Navier-Stokes equation is incomplete in terms of describing the physical system, because it has coarse-grained over all the microscopic degrees of freedom, it has essentially smoothed out the effect of thermal noise on the system. Now, that can be remedied in the fashion that Landau told us about in Landau and Lifshitz, 1959, where he discusses stochastic hydrodynamics, where he takes the Navier-Stokes equation and or the Businewski equations, and after the fact adds the noise back in by adding a stochastic stress tensor to the equations. So we want to explore in experiments whether we can see any of these interesting effects. Let me just discuss one or two more parameters. There's a thing called the Prandtl number, which is the ratio of the kinematic viscosity to the thermal diffusivity. And an important parameter is this epsilon, which is a dimensionless measure of how far from the bifurcation we are. The bifurcation occurs when delta T equals delta TC, so epsilon is zero. Positive epsilon means we are in the above the bifurcation in the pattern-forming regime. Negative epsilon means we are below the bifurcation, where deterministically nothing should be going on. There are three aspects to this issue that I want to discuss. One of them is the fluctuations below the bifurcation. The next one will be the effect of fluctuations on the bifurcation itself. It seems it indeed has a profound effect. And the third one is the effect of fluctuations on the supposedly ordered state that occurs above the bifurcation. Well, in principle, as I already mentioned, the problem can be discussed in terms of the stochastic Businewski equations. That would be the fully three-dimensional problem. A simplification has been introduced by Swift and Hohenberg, who introduced the equation which we now know as the Swift-Hohenberg equation, which simplifies the problem to two dimensions. And it has a white noise source, eta, acting on this system. And the white noise intensity is called F sub TH for thermal, and I'm not going to discuss any of this in any detail. At the linear level, yeah?
I always thought that equation was supposed to be qualitatively correct. Are you saying we should take it more seriously than that?
Oh, you should take it much more seriously. I'll tell you in the sense in which it is correct. Its derivation from the Businewski equations is not systematic, but it retains the symmetry of the really binaire system, the rotational invariance, which is contained in that operator. Where it attains legitimacy is if you derive a Ginzburg-Landau equation from this equation, that Ginzburg-Landau equation is identical to the one that you would derive from the Businewski equations. This is the Newell-Whitehead-Siegel equation. Okay, so that's basically the situation. Okay, now, if you ignore the nonlinearity, of course, you throw a lot of the interesting things away, but something remains, and you can actually solve the stochastic equation. And the solution is that psi squared average is equal to this thermal noise intensity, the intensity of this stuff here, divided by the square root of the absolute value of epsilon. This, of course, is valid for epsilon less than zero, where the deterministic equations tell us that nothing's going on. Okay, so we get a noise intensity that should diverge at the bifurcation as the square root of minus epsilon. Of course, we know it has to stay finite. Noise intensity has to stay finite. So this has to break down as we approach epsilon equals zero from below. And it breaks down because these nonlinearities will cause the fluctuation to saturate. The noise intensity is calculated here. It's the ratio between K. Boltzmann and the macroscopic energy. D group rho is the mass, and nu over d is the velocity, so it's the mass times the velocity squared that we have sitting here. But this is a macroscopic quantity compared to a microscopic one, so we expect this to be a rather small number for typical physical systems, and therefore fluctuation effects are small, are difficult to see, and generally have not been seen prior to the work I will tell you about. Now, there are some other factors. This is just a numerical factor, and then there's a nu over kappa sitting out here, and that'll be important for us a little bit later. Now, what Swift and Hornberg have told us on the basis of this equation is that the fluctuations have a very profound effect on the bifurcation. We know from an analysis of the deterministic equations by Schlüter, Lorz, and Busse that the bifurcation is supercritical. That's a rigorous result for Rayleigh-Binet, and it's experimentally verified in many, many systems. Now, Swift and Hornberg have told us that the noise causes the bifurcation to be altered into a subcritical bifurcation. So it's expected to be a subcritical, a noise-induced subcritical bifurcation. And this is based on the work of Brazovsky on systems of this particular symmetry. Swift and Hornberg also tell us that the critical region in which we can see these nonlinear effects due to fluctuations has a width of order f to the 2/3. Well, when f is small, f to the 2/3 is still small, so presumably we have to look very close to the bifurcation to see these effects. Well, let's see how that proceeds. Here's this formula again. If we do a typical convection experiment using water as a fluid, F thermal is 10 to the minus 9 and epsilon critical is 10 to the minus 6, and we poor experimentalists don't have a chance of seeing anything. Okay, so we're not going to try this experiment with water. Over the last 10 years or so, we've developed methods of using compressed carbon dioxide, or also compressed sulfur hexafluoride, as the fluid in which to study Rayleigh-Binet convection. And now we suddenly find that F thermal is about 3 times 10 to the minus 7. Epsilon critical is 5 times 10 to the minus 5. This is beginning to be more palatable in terms of making experimental measurements. I don't think we can hope to see this, but even outside of epsilon critical, we can hope to see fluctuations, but they would behave according to the linear results based on Swift-Hornberg. And by the way, this formula also has been derived for the linear Bussinesky equations by Van Buren and Cohen. It's identical to the formula that we had for the Swift-Hornberg equation. Somewhat surprising, but true. Well, okay. In 1995, Ming-Ming Wu and our group made some measurements on this system, carbon dioxide, pressure of 42 bars, epsilon of 2 times 10 to the minus 4, and she found this picture of the fluctuations. Now, the images I will show you are obtained by the shadowgraph method. They are obtained by looking from the top down on the sample. So the sample is down here, and we look down on it. And I'm not going to discuss the shadowgraph method unless somebody wants to ask me about it. It's a way of visualizing, basically, the temperature field. Now, Ming-Ming believes that there are fluctuations visible in here, and the skeptic would say there's a lot of experimental noise visible in here. And to make it more concrete, you can take this picture, Fourier transform it, look at the modulus of the Fourier transform, and that is done here. So we now have a wave director K that has components Q and P, and we see that the Fourier transform of this image is a ring in Fourier space. The ring has precisely the radius that corresponds to the modulus of the wave director for the onset of Rayleigh-Binet convection. So that's very convincing that indeed the signal here has to do with fluctuations that are associated with really benign stability. Well, since we have, well, the other thing that we see from this image is the rotational invariance of the system. The really benign problem has no preferred direction in the plane. The rolls can have any orientation, so that when we see linear fluctuations, we have superposition of fluctuations of all orientations and all phases. And that's what this horrible picture over here is. It's a superposition of all these different modes. And in the Fourier transform, we see that indeed all orientations are more or less equally represented. That being the case, we might as well integrate the total power and see how that total power then compares with the prediction that we had here that said it should be this F divided by the square root of epsilon. Well, the results of that integration now at many epsilon values and for two different pressures are shown here. They're shown on log scales. And in fact, the fluctuations in the shadow graph image have been converted into actual temperature fluctuations as in Kelvin squared. And that can be done in a straightforward fashion. So we have delta T squared averaged in Kelvin squared as a function of epsilon on log scales. And the data points are obviously the data points. And the solid lines are the prediction based on this noise intensity. And there are no adjustable parameters. Okay, so we have taken basically Landau fluctuating hydrodynamics at the linear level, predicted what should happen, and compared it with experiment. And the agreement is well, you can judge for yourself. I think it's really excellent. So this is a nice confirmation, quantitative confirmation of the Landau way of putting the noise back into the equations of motion. Well, that's all well and good, but we would like to, of course, now like to see these nonlinear effects that Swift and Holmberg have told us about, but we have to go to 5 times 10 to the minus 5, which is over here somewhere, and Ming-Ming already had to work very hard to get to this point, and we really can't do it too well in this system. But fortunately, there are ways of making the situation more favorable, and that is by focusing on this contribution to the noise intensity, the effective noise intensity. There's a viscosity and there's a thermal diffusivity. If we can find a system where the viscosity stays sort of normal, constant, and the thermal diffusivity becomes very small, then we get a large value for this thermal noise intensity. And that is precisely what happens near a liquid gas critical point. So we look at the critical point of sulfohexafluoride, and here's the phase diagram, temperature versus density. Here's the phase separation curve, and we have a liquid at high density, and we have a gas at low density, and this is a critical isochore here in the middle of the dotted line. And then we have the solid lines, the two solid lines. Those are two isobars. Now we will put our sample right smack here on the critical isochore, and then we put a delta T across it, and the bottom will go up to this circle, and the top will go up to that circle. So we have a delta T across it, and convection will start, and the sample itself will sit on the isobar, but the average, the middle of the sample, will sit also on the isochore at the same time. It turns out that along this isochore, if we come down this way, the thermal diffusivity goes to zero at the critical point. It's a well-known property, a thermodynamic property, well, transport property, near a liquid gas critical point. And here's a graph of F thermal times D, I've taken the D over there, against temperature, and it just goes up. So we can tune the system to give us any noise intensity we like, within experimental limitations. So I will tell you about data on this one and on that one. And on the bottom one here, on this isobar, well, the sample thickness is 34 micrometers. The thermal noise intensity is 5 times 10 to the minus 4. And the epsilon C of Schwarzschild-Homburg is 6 times 10 to the minus 3, eminently manageable. On this upper one here, the sample thickness was 59 micrometers, the noise intensity is 0.8 times 10 to the minus 4, epsilon C is 2 times 10 to the minus 3. So let's look at some of this. We now have so much resolution here that we can actually see the fluctuations a long way below the bifurcation. Here's a snapshot to be compared with the one Ming-Ming took, where she had to struggle to see anything. This snapshot is taken 6% below the bifurcation. Epsilon is minus 0.06. And more than that, we can now take this thing and make a movie of it. And we can see, indeed, there are fluctuations. They have a dynamics. What you're seeing here, in real space, is equivalent to critical opalescence near a liquid gas critical point, where, the fluid becomes milky because there are density fluctuations, but in that case, the size of the density fluctuations is of the order of the wavelength of light. You know, here it's of the order of the sample thickness, right? And or longer. You can also, if you like, if you prefer, you can watch the movie in Fourier space. Right? Here's the modulus of the Fourier transform, and you see the dynamics of the fluctuations. Well, in view of the rotational invariance of the system, we might as well take the azimuthal average and just look at the intensity of the fluctuations as a function of the wave number. And that, of course, we call the structure factor. That is shown here. The structure factor is a function of the wave number. And these are the epsilon values. We're now a long, long way below the bifurcation. We're almost at equilibrium here, right? We are at minus 0.78, so we're only, at a delta T, that's only 22% of the critical value for the onset of convection. So this has nothing to do with really being our convection anymore, in a sense. It just, it's the fluctuations of a fluid in a thermal gradient. And the lines going through the curves are a calculation based on the linear Businesky equations by Otto Stitterati and Sengers. And so this is very nice. Here we have on a log-log scale the same data, and we can see now the prediction is that at large k, the structure factor should go as k to the minus 4. The k to the minus 4 simply comes from the fact that you have two modes, a temperature mode and a velocity mode. Each one of them would by itself would go as k to the minus 2, but even in the linear system, they're coupled by virtue of the noise acting on the system. And this coupling produces a k to the minus 4 dependence out here. The turnover is due to the fact that the fluctuations occur in a finite system, so fluctuations of very large wavelength in the vertical direction are cut off by the finite plate spacing. So that happens at k of order pi. Lengths are all scaled by the sample thickness, so k of order pi is where the wavelength is twice the thickness. And then at small k, this drops off as k to the minus 2, and all that agrees very nicely between theory and experiment. There are also measurements of the dynamics, the relaxation rates, or the growth rate of the fluctuations, shown here as a function of k for several different negative epsilon values. And here you see that the growth rate, which is negative, of course, we are below the bifurcation, it becomes smaller, at least at the critical wave vector for Rayleigh-Binard convection. And of course, it will have to vanish at the Rayleigh-Binard point. All right, so you see the critical slowing down expressed in these data. So all that became accessible by going to the critical point. But the interesting thing really is what happens if we now go closer to the Rayleigh-Binard bifurcation. And now we enter the nonlinear regime, where a linear theory will no longer help us very much. So here are some shadowgraph images close to the bifurcation. This is epsilon of 0.007, and this is minus 0.007, right? So it's all within less than 1%. So a small step down has changed the pattern from roles. Here we have roles. We expect roles above onset. That is again in agreement with Friedel, Lotz, and Busse, who did this beautiful calculation back in the 1960s. And then, bingo, all of a sudden, you take a small step and you have a disordered pattern of fluctuations. And here you can look in Fourier space and see the result. For the roles, you have a pair of spots, the K and minus K, basically, representing the roles. And then here you have a ring in Fourier space. As you go down further, 5% below, the ring in Fourier space broadens. This is all just the way we would expect it to be. Now again, let's take the total intensity around this ring. Right? Let's integrate that and look at the intensity as a function of epsilon. The data are here. Up here, the shadow graph method is becoming nonlinear because it's obviously tuned up to measure these very small fluctuations, and so it's not doing well up there. But okay, the same data are shown here on log-log scale. Okay, so you have the data above and below. And the interesting thing is that the solid line is the prediction based on the Swift-Hohenberg equation, on the nonlinear Swift-Hohenberg equation, for which Swift and Hohenberg give an analytic solution. I think it involves some approximations, but I'm not going to get into that. So there's an analytic solution which we fitted to these data. It's valid both above and below. And there's a jump here. Right? So this very rapid increase here, right at the bifurcation point, is of course suggestive of a first order phase transition as they had predicted. The fit of Swift-Hohenberg to the data gives us a noise intensity of 7 times 10 to the minus 4, and the theoretical number that we calculated from the fluid properties is 5 times 10 to the minus 4. So this is very convincing that, indeed everything is hanging together. Let's see. Now, the most persuasive evidence that indeed the physical system has a subcritical bifurcation, I think, is contained here. What we're looking at here is the fluctuation power as a function of time, and this top trace is for a temperature difference across a sample of 146 millidegrees. And it's more or less steady. There's some fluctuations, as we expect for a system that's acted on by the stochastic force. But more or less, we are sitting at 0.18 or 0.2 or something like that. And then we drop down half a millidegree in delta T to 145.5. And now we have this trace where we go from a high-intensity state to a low-intensity state rather abruptly. Then we go back up, and then we go down again. And then if we go another half a millidegree, we're sitting down here steadily. Okay. So this one, this case, is sitting right at the bifurcation point. And lo and behold, the system fluctuates between two states. So there's bistability. We could not have bistability if we had a supercritical bifurcation. Now, it's interesting to look at the patterns. We have these points A, B, C, and D. And they are A, B, C, and D. At A, we have roles. At B, we have fluctuations. C, we have roles. D, we have fluctuations. D is down here, fluctuations. All right, so clearly it is going between the ordered state and the disordered state, or the solid and the liquid, if you like. Okay. Now, I would like to show you this particular trace in the form of a movie, so you can see it going from this to that to that to that as a function of time. It's still solid, still frozen. Okay, and come on, that melts, okay. And that froze again, okay, and that melted again, okay. Now there was a question? Where the heck was it? Next one. It's 80 minutes covered by this, right? So you're right, it's about an hour. Okay? So we can just run through that once more. All right. Now the ordered state still has a lot of disorder in it. Right? That's already, of course, that's quite interesting. But here you see it melted. Not, you know, it didn't perhaps perfectly melt, but then it, you know, refroze again, and there it goes. Okay, so that's the main evidence that indeed, in the presence of fluctuations, the Rayleigh Binet system is entered via a subcritical bifurcation. Of course, I might add that you would not expect to see any hysteresis in a case like this, because it's really a subcritical bifurcation in the presence of strong noise. Right? So you would get a transition at the thermodynamic transition point, right, where the two potentials are equal, if you can speak in potential terms. Here's the other isobar, and the sample thickness is 59 micrometers. Oh, this should be micrometers here, not millimeters. No, this is right, 0.059 millimeters, so it's 59 micrometer.
Do you have a sort of equivalent
of the
energy described in the
transition? Pardon? Yes, the deterministic Swift-Hohenberg equation has the potential. So at that level, at least, at the Swift-Hohenberg approximation, there is a free energy. Yes. You have two branches. You have bistability for the deterministic equation, but the stochastic system is not going to be able to trace out a hysteresis loop, because the noise is strong enough that it will always pick the solution with the lowest free energy. Except as you saw right at the bifurcation point, it can switch back and forth between the two. Okay. All right, so here's the other isobar, and again, the data points, the solid line is a fit of Swift-Hohenberg to these data points, and this time we get a noise intensity of 1.4 times 10 to the minus 4 from the experiment, and 0.8 times 10 to the minus 4 from the theory, and this is still well within uncertainties. One has to know fluid properties accurately and all that sort of thing, so... So I still find this extremely satisfactory. Now, the next interesting issue, the third one I listed at the beginning, is what about the ordered state, the so-called ordered state, the convection rolls above the bifurcation? Well, they too will have their own disorder, and this was discussed by Turner and Nelson, 1981. Turner and Nelson said that you should get various excitations of these rolls. In particular, they identify two kinds of phonons. There are these undulatory phonons, these compressional phonons. In the compressional phonons, the wave director is modulated, and in here the orientation is the wave number is modulated here, and here the angle of the wave director is modulated. And then there might be various defects like dislocations and disclinations. Disclinations have a relatively high energy, and the dislocations have a finite excitation energy, so one might see those. So that's something we should be looking for. So let me tell you a little bit about some image analysis here. This is not quite a raw image, but a relatively unprocessed image. And the Fourier transform is sitting here. And now we can apply a bandpass filter to throw out some experimental noise that just is not is totally out of the picture as far as the physics is concerned, and that's sort of indicated by these faint circles here. Everything inside that circle and outside that one is thrown away. Then we back transform, we get this thing here, and that looks a little cleaner than that. But there's still a lot of structure in here. There are these little pearls along the rolls. And so the question is, what are those pearls? That's the first question I want to ask. Well, you probably cannot see it, particularly with this projector, which isn't all that great, but there's a faint ring here in Fourier space going around. And if I now take the radial average here in Fourier space, and plot that radial average as a function of azimuthal angle, I get these open circles in this graph. Okay, now this is a log scale, so this big peak here sticks out by two orders of magnitude. That peak is this spot up here, right? And this only goes from zero to pi because I only need half of this. And then there's these open circles here that form a background. That background is a faint ring that goes all the way around. Okay, so there is a background of fluctuations, isotropic fluctuations, rotationally invariant. And superimposed upon that are these convection rolls. Now, these guys, I can filter out. I'll put a circular filter around my Fourier peak. The result of that is shown by these solid circles. And if I take this after that filtering and back transform, I get this pattern. And now I see that all the little pearls are gone. Okay. So these pearls, these pearly appearance here, was due to these isotropic fluctuations. Now, let's see. Yeah. Now, I can now take these open circles here and draw a straight line across there and thereby ignore this peak and integrate over theta. Right? Basically, I just take the average value multiplied by pi. Right, and I get the total fluctuation power that is in the fluctuations as opposed to the really benign rolls. And when I do that, I can now plot the power against, this should be the modulus of epsilon. I get these open circles from the procedure I just described above the bifurcation. And below the bifurcation, I get these solid circles by taking the total power of the fluctuations. So I see that an equal distance from the bifurcation point, above or below, I have the same fluctuation intensity. And then, of course, if I include the this big spike here that corresponds to the rolls, I get something up there. So this is one interesting thing we learned. The fluctuations are symmetric about the bifurcation, shown on linear scales again here. Right here we are below, and then here we are above. And they coexist above. They coexist with the convection rolls.
They don't diverge.
Well, it's they presumably don't diverge because we believe it's a first order transition. But it's pretty hard to show experimentally whether something diverges or doesn't diverge. So No, they shouldn't diverge. They shouldn't diverge anyway because of even if it were a supercritical bifurcation, you're quite right, because of the nonlinear saturation. Right? Linearly, they would diverge as 1 over square root of epsilon here. Right? But for the nonlinear system, they are going to stay finite. Okay. Well, we can do some more analysis. We can take this pattern that has been cleaned up a little bit the way I described before to get rid of the pearly effect, and we can now demodulate the system. Demodulation is done by taking the Fourier transform and taking one of the peaks, setting it to zero, and keeping only the remaining one peak, and back transforming into a real space. If you then take the square of the modulus of the back transform, you get the envelope. You get the envelope of these rolls. That is, you get the amplitude, the local amplitude of the convection rolls. Okay, so by demodulation, you can get this local amplitude. Now we see that the local amplitude has structure. These rolls are not of uniform amplitude everywhere, and the structure is interestingly highly correlated in the direction of the wave director, and it is correlated over shorter lengths in the direction of the roll axis. So this is interesting. There's no theory that I know of for this. There are no quantitative measurements. It would be good now to take this and measure correlation functions, but we haven't done that as yet. This is the phase that comes out of the demodulation procedure, and it looks just like the pattern itself, more or less. We can also do local wave director measurements on this. We can, at every point in this image, we can determine the direction and magnitude of the wave director. This is now not by Fourier techniques, but in real space, measuring the wave director. There are ways for doing that. And this is the local modulus of the wave director. There isn't much structure in that. So what this tells us is that we have so far been unable to see the compressional phonons that Toner and Nelson were talking about, because they should occur, they should show up as stripes in here, and we don't see them. We can also look at the angle, the local angle of the wave director, and that angle in rendered in grayscales is shown here. And now we see the angle of these rolls has all kinds of structure in it, and that basically means that the undulatory phonons of Toner and Nelson are indeed observable. Okay? And again, they are highly correlated in the direction of the wave director and correlated over shorter length scales in the other direction. So we have the undulatory phonons of Toner and Nelson. Now, here's another picture. In this picture, you will see the undulations of the, when I run the movie, the undulations of the rolls. You will also see a lot of defect dislocation activity. So these occur simultaneously. And this is a rendering on a false color scale of the angle of these rolls. So the right side is the angle of the wave director. Okay? And this is the actual roll pattern.
So do you mean the angle of the roll, or do you mean the angle of those little pearls
inside the roll? No, the pearls are gone. The pearls we've taken out. Right. This is the angle of these rolls. This is over a very narrow angular range. Right. As your eye tells you, the angle doesn't vary very much, but it does vary. Right. And so the small range of angular variation is expanded over this color scale. So let's see. So now on the left you have the actual rolls, and here you see the angle that corresponds to it. Right? So you can see the undulations in here, and you can see red changing to blue, etc. And of course, when there is a dislocation activity, you see a lot of activity here too. Right? So there's a dynamics of these undulations. It's a relatively slow dynamics, much slower than any dynamics of dislocations when it takes place, but it's there. So those are the undulatory phonons. There's obviously a great deal of work to be done now on quantifying these qualitative observations. Here's another example of the formation of a dislocation, which you already saw in the previous movies. This is a time sequence. 1 through 6, and here you see one of these phonons developing a relatively large amplitude, and this is really what happens. These phonons develop a large amplitude and become highly nonlinear, get steeper and steeper, and it's like a breaking wave that develops a crest, and then it breaks, and when it breaks, it makes a dislocation. Yeah. Once the dislocation forms, it glides out of the area of observation. Okay, so dislocations are born via the large amplitude nonlinear phonons. Okay, so they're connected to each other. Right? So these are two important ingredients of the dynamics of the so-called ordered state. Well, 10 minutes I have, huh?
Yes, including questions.
Oh, including questions. Well, I was going to tell you about a completely different system, and I'll only be able to tell you rather briefly, but that's all right. After all, there are other systems in the world besides Rayleigh-Binard, and one interesting system is electroconvection in a pneumatic liquid crystal. Now, a pneumatic is a fluid. It pours readily, but it consists of elongated molecules. And those elongated molecules, by virtue of steric hindrance, like to line up relative to each other. And Stephen Morris is one of the world's experts on this, so I'm hesitant to say very much for fear that he will correct me. But Anyway, one can provoke these molecules to all align more or less in the same direction between two glass plates. And that direction, that preferred direction, is called the director. So now we don't have an isotropic system anymore. Right? We don't have rotational invariance in that plane. We have a preferred direction singled out. By now applying a voltage between the top and bottom plate, there's an electrode on it, applying a voltage, we can induce convection. Convection rolls that are voltage-induced rather than induced by a temperature gradient. And again, we have an epsilon and all that sort of thing. The rolls that form can now have an oblique angle relative to the director, this angle theta. The driving is done with an alternating voltage that has some frequency in hertz as a function of the applied voltage, of the frequency of the applied voltage. The obliqueness angle theta can vary and can go to zero at some point and then stay zero. This is an interesting point. It's a so-called Lipschitz point. And from equilibrium critical phenomena, we know that behavior near Lipschitz points is different from behavior away from Lipschitz points. So we can immediately see that there's a richness of phenomena to be seen here. We don't expect the Brazovsky effect, which is a fluctuation-induced first-order transition, because for that we have to have the rotational invariance. That's a crucial ingredient of that universality class. We expect different kind of critical behavior, but we expect something, one kind here, another kind at the Lipschitz point, maybe another kind out here, and really theoretically it hasn't been investigated all that much. To emphasize the difference between the systems, here once more is Rayleigh-Binard. Here's Rayleigh-Binard. And the structure factor for Rayleigh-Binard is you know, indicated here as a Lorentzian. For electroconvection, the structure factor is more complicated. There's a P and Q components of the wave director, and we have these various terms. And here is the real space picture of the fluctuations, and here is the Fourier transform. We see now that we have two pairs of spots corresponding to these two kinds of rolls, called zig and zag rolls. Well, here's just a list of the different kinds of bifurcation systems we can have. We can have stationary bifurcations to normal rolls. Normal rolls means the zero angle of obliqueness, or oblique rolls, or we can have a Lipschitz point, as I just explained. We can also have Hopf bifurcations in this system. And when I say also, I mean by varying the fluid properties and whatnot, there's a great richness that you can achieve in a well-controlled way. So we can have normal traveling rolls or oblique traveling rolls. Again, we can have Lipschitz points. And since we have stationary and Hopf bifurcations, we can also have codimension 2 points in this system. Then there's another case of so-called homeotropic alignment, which I didn't mention. That's the case where the director is orthogonal to the plates, right? The planar alignment that I discussed a little bit, the director is parallel to the confining plates, but we can also cause the director to be orthogonal to the confining plates. And then we can have a so-called Frederick's transition. It's a thermodynamic phase transition that can precede the electroconvection. Or we can go directly to electroconvection. If we go in homeotropic alignment directly to electroconvection, then we have preserved the rotational invariance, and again, that system should be in the Brazovsky universality class. Right? Hasn't been investigated yet. Thermal noise intensity can be estimated. There's not an exact calculation like for Rayleigh-Binard, but it's something like K Boltzmann T divided by some elastic energy. K is an elastic constant here. It's of order 10 to the minus 5, which is somewhat smaller than the, you know, in the Rayleigh-Binard system, we talked about 10 to the minus 4. Okay, and for this case, you can write a Ginzburg-Landau equation, and it has these anisotropic gradient terms in it. Right? That just illustrates that, you know, this is very different from Rayleigh-Binard, has different symmetries, and should show different critical behavior. There are some measurements that we have made. The open circles are for a system that undergoes a Hopf bifurcation to oblique rolls. The solid circles are for a system that undergoes a stationary bifurcation to oblique rolls. And we notice that the power versus epsilon is really quite different for the two cases. So the way the bifurcation point is approached is quite different in the two systems. So showing that there really is a richness of phenomena to be expected in this system. Well, let me summarize what I've told you. We've seen fluctuations near the Rayleigh-Benard stability, and they should fall into the Brazovsky universality class, and indeed we've obtained fairly convincing evidence that the fluctuation is that the bifurcation is a fluctuation-induced first-order transition. In the striped phase, the ordered phase, there are fluctuations, and there are phonons, and there are amplitude modulations, and there are roll angle modulations, and there are dislocations. In electroconvection, we have measured fluctuations near a bifurcation to oblique traveling waves and to stationary oblique rolls. There are also measurements near the Lipschitz point, which I haven't shown you. But we have really very little to guide us theoretically in terms of interpreting this. We do not have the equivalent of the analysis of the Swift-Hornberg equation, so there's a lot of room here for theoretical work. There's an outline of possible different universality classes. Does it have anything to do with other systems? Well, it does. The microcrystallization of diblock copolymers, we heard a little bit about diblock copolymers at this meeting, for certain ratios, well, for the fraction of the two parts of the diblock copolymer being equal, there's an equilibrium phase transition, and it is of the Brazovsky type, the same as Rayleigh-Benard convection. That was shown by Frederickson and co-workers. There are also striped phases in two-dimensional Coulomb gases that are of great interest in solid-state physics. There are high-TC superconductors, but perhaps more interestingly, there are two-dimensional high lambda levels that form these striped phases, the charge density waves, and I think some of the things we discussed may be relevant there. And I guess that's the end of what I have to tell you with 2 minutes to spare. Thank you very much.